Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does an artist determine the balance between classicism and iconoclasm in a single project and over the course of a lifelong career? As a dancer, director, and choreographer, Twyla Tharp has drawn that line in many different places, sometimes moving and bending and even erasing it within the same work. Her credits include more than 135 choreographed dances performed all over the world, along with 5 movies and 3 Broadway shows. In her career, she has earned Tony and Emmy Awards, a MacArthur Genius Grant, Kennedy Center Honors, and the National Medal of the Arts. And I am delighted that she could make time to be here. Twyla, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What does dance convey more effectively than other forms of art?
Emotional thinking. I think we like to say that, or at least I do, dance is a nonverbal art form, by which I mean that visually communication can be established, that perhaps language belies. You can lie in language. You can't lie in action.
Is dance ever limited by its inherent beauty?
Now, what do you mean, inherent beauty?
Well, I think most people think of watching human bodies move on a stage in a choreographed way as very attractive to look at.
The reason I ask you to be more specific about inherent beauty is one of the components that people tend to think of in relation to dance and the ballet is a kind of grace and airiness that seems as though it's otherworldly, that it's counter to gravity. And this, of course, is an illusion. Not to say that it's not good for our souls or that it's not that beauty in and of itself doesn't have a kind of component of positive, optimistic. Things can be elevated, and this is a good thing. On the other hand, it is not natural. It's very artificial. It's very stylized. So just to, as a viewer, to be aware that what I started out by saying, namely that action does not lie, is in and of itself a lie.
When you are working with dancers, do you look at them as, I mean, objects for manipulation, or do you think of them as artists in their own right? Because if you're choreographing them, it's really your vision and not theirs.
Yes and no. One of the things that I do or have thought about doing is language. While on the one hand, dance is a nonverbal art form, I've written 2 books, one of which is called The Creative Habit. Published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm working now on a 3rd book called The Collaborative Habit, because the question that you ask is very much at the center of this art form, which is collaborative. I mean, okay, yes, I could at one point have done everything and made a solo concert, but for the most part, certainly in my career, I have built pieces that require the participation of many folks, and I don't look at dancers as tools. I don't look at them as ciphers. I do look at them as individuals who bring to the work at hand their own past, their own training, their own personalities, their own sense of what they would like to see materialize in this work for themselves, as well as what I want to get done.
What does it take when you're casting dancers in a particular work to know what they're capable of and what they can be pushed to do and where their limits lie?
This all has to do with, again, and I'm talking here, always taking notes for the new book, right, Collaborative Habit, but that the more familiar one is with the resources, the folks you're working with, the more inventive and challenging you can make the work. If it's a new dancer, somebody I've never worked with before, I can know them from repertory they have danced. I can certainly know them from their technique. What I don't know is, say, their stayability. How deeply will they dig in? How much will they insist on finding a way to do something? How much will they let something very difficult go away? And all of this is has a big impact on what I can accomplish. And as I come to know them in that format, being something of a pragmatist, I will gauge and gear the challenge that I might suggest to what I think is realistic from their point of view.
It's really different, I guess, as an artist from other media that you might work with, because you have to sort of factor in human fallibility and the fact that people have a good day or a bad day.
Oh, we hate that. Really hate that. The good day, bad day part is not acceptable. That's called being a professional. You do not have good days and bad days. You're allowed to have days that are better than others. That's it. I'm teasing you. I'm teasing you. A professional has to come into the studio and be prepared to work whatever disaster, tragedy, or happiness has hit them. In terms of other kinds of fallibilities, I mean, yeah, you can also, and sometimes it's necessary in a commercial project, treat people simply as though there's a job to be done. Guys, let's get it done. We have 10 days here. We got to get this thing up. This is what I need from you. This is what we need here. Let's go. So that happens too, and that's valid. Look at an orchestra. Often they'll come in to rehearse very limited time with music that's been written long in advance and just do the execution. And there can be some of that in working with dancers.
What about when you are communicating and collaborating with artists from other media, whether it's costume designers or set designers or musicians? Is there a different sort of language that you have to use to make sure that you both understand each other?
Yes, it is. There are about 42,000 questions in that question you've mm-hmm. just asked. If you're working with a composer, it's very different from working with a designer. So let's just stay with those two categories for a moment. Composers, working with a commissioned score, which I did last year twice in one year. One was with a film score, a gentleman who's known mostly as a film scorer, Danny Elfman. And the other gentleman named Elvis Costello. Both did new commissioned scores for new ballets. In speaking with them, in the first phases of the project, I try to analyze what's realistic to ask of them, much as with a dancer, in terms of what kind of time we're talking about here. These are both very busy men, and get some sense as to what they think a dance might be. How is this ballet different for Elvis than writing a song? How is this ballet different for Danny than scoring, a Hollywood action picture? Or how do their experiences in these other areas bring something very interesting to bear here on the possibility of a ballet score? That's just for starters. And then one needs to get into process. How do they work? In both of their cases, these were distance collaborations. Danny is on the West Coast. I live in New York. Elvis was touring, actually, during most of the time when he was working. And so what is the process for exchanging information? What kind of regularity, what kind of routine can it have so that there can be you're starting out here when you're working with someone else on a project that is going to create something unseen there's no description of where are we going here. We're just starting out with, faith and a shoestring, I don't know, then bit by bit evolving and defining what can be done, and some good surprises, and then learning other things that become restrictions. It sounds very difficult, doesn't it?
It does
kind of sound kind of amazing that anything gets done, doesn't it? I must say both ballets got up. Both of them were long for ballets. Both of them were over 40 minutes, which is a long single act ballet. And there you are. It's a mysterious process in some ways. It is something that one's very grateful for, but that there is not a whole lot of science behind.
How critical is risk tolerance for creating really good art?
What do you mean risk tolerance? You mean something is not going to work, or you mean something is going to fall off the cliff, or you mean what you mean risk tolerance?
I suppose I mean just doing something that's not been done before, that you haven't tried before, but you really want to experiment with it.
Well, for me, risk, if that's what you're calling risk tolerance, is the only thing that is of any value, because if I'm not doing something I don't that if what I'm working on is something I already know how to do, the only reason I'm doing that is because somebody's paying me a lot of money to do it. Whereas if there's something I don't know how to do, then I'm really curious about that and I'm interested in that. And that's much more challenging for me. So I suppose from that point of view, I must have risk. So my tolerance must be humongous for risk.
Well, after 40-something years, it seems like it would be harder and harder to find things that are risky because you can already forecast in your mind how something will work.
Well, this is a very interesting point. Yes and no. It's called experience. I think that an artist who works for over a career with various periods and phases and works constantly is going to evolve and learn lessons, but at the same time ask different questions. So it's six of one, half dozen of another. I mean, on the one hand, there's something in the new book I call the Plautus factor, which is to say that any problem that materializes in the last analysis is going to have been there from day one. And guess what? You've been avoiding it since day one.
Consciously or unconsciously.
Yes. And so as one knows that to be the case, suddenly working becomes about looking over your shoulder and going, okay, where's the Plautus factor? What is it? What is it? As opposed to looking ahead and going, oh, that looks good. That looks exciting. Rather than with this over-the-shoulder look, uh-oh, that's going to betray me. I better not go there. Second-guessing yourself, in essence, I guess is what I'm saying, which bleeds enthusiasm. On the other hand, it is part and parcel of wisdom. So there you are.
Do you visualize your career as having sort of a beginning and a middle and a later phase, and are they distinct for you?
I do. I look at my career in 20-year chunks, two of which are completed. The last is not. It will be whatever it will be. The first 20 years were spent working basically with a small group on projects that didn't have a lot of definition in advance. There were some films in there, which obviously you know what your job is going into it. But this was mostly about defining dance. The second 20 years had more to do with working somewhat commercially in the world of the ballet, the Broadway shows. And there it's a freelance kind of working situation, not so embedded as the first 20 years, but, you know, making large works. Really, the reason I undertook that phase was to work with many larger structures than what I could afford on my own. I couldn't afford a chorus, say, an ensemble of dancers, 24 girls in the background. And I wanted to learn about bigger forces. Obviously, I couldn't afford to mount a Broadway show or put up a movie. And all of those huge collaborative situations are very commercial. And that was a 20-year chunk of time. And now I'm looking at the rest, whatever it is to be, as an amalgam of all the above, and heaven only knows what it will be called.
Twyla Tharp is my guest. We'll resume our conversation in just a moment.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is choreographer, writer, and director Twyla Tharp. You are also trained as a musician yourself. Are you still, do you still practice that?
No, I haven't played either viola, violin, or piano for a very long time.
Did you find that it was a different, when you were playing, was it an entirely different way of expressing yourself as an artist than working in dance?
It obviously, the skill sets are completely different. The process, if which I had the experience of doing, you're working inside an ensemble, say a string quartet, the experience of working with others as intimately, the collaborative experience of a quartet made it possible for me to understand this with a group of dancers, the same kind of cooperative venture as opposed to isolated within a group. So I would say that that experience was very, very valuable.
I have a colleague with a well-worn copy of your book, The Creative Habit, on his shelf.
Yay! Thank you.
Who describes it as basically tough love for creative people. Uh-huh. Do you think that there are a lot of creative people who lack discipline and therefore...
Yes, I think there are a lot of people who lack discipline. Mm-hmm. And I understand. It's not fun. Well, it is fun, and it is reassuring. I'm extreme. Let's just get that out there right away. I have, because I've been trained since I was a very small child by my mother to be completely engrossed in the discipline at hand, if that's called for. Most folks both resent this and find it impossible to do. On the other hand, any writer I'm sure that sits here will tell you that to write, you got to sit and look at that blank page for regular amounts of time at a regular time on regular days, and there's just no two ways around it. You can't be a serious artist every other day.
So, in other words, there's essentially effort that goes into it as opposed to waiting for inspiration to come from on high.
Absolutely. I mean, there is a difference between the person who works with a real commitment to an art form and a craft and what's called a dilettante. And I have terrific respect for both sides. So the person who looks at the work of art as a relaxation, as a way of distracting themselves, as a way of reaching out, even as a way of making a gift for someone, literally. This is fantastic. But it's not the same thing as a person who is looking to alter the art form.
What relationship do you feel you have with audiences who come to your work?
I don't know about the relationship. I think I have a responsibility. My sense is to try to create a time to spend together where boredom will not be a partner, and where when the audience leaves, they will feel differently than when they came in. And I would say that in general, I'm an optimist, and I would like that differently to feel better than when they came in.
You are in your mid-60s now. I wonder if your body still serves you the way you need and want it to.
Well, now let's think about that, shall we? That was very nicely put, but unfortunately the answer is what you expect it to be. I still work myself physically quite a bit and can still do quite a lot, but it certainly doesn't anymore come for free. And it also, I mean, there's no way I can drive as hard as I could even 5 years ago, certainly not 10 years ago, and that's just the way it is. Of course, and it is as an athlete, let's say, it obviously is a difficult path to look forward when the return is diminishing. On the other hand, the path could be a lot less possible if one doesn't invest. So there really is no choice, is what I'm saying. And yes, it does decline.
Is there a grieving process that takes place when you start to see this happening and
feel
it happening?
Does it sound like it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there you are. There is a grieving process that takes place. I suggest it best be done with a sense of humor.
Do you ever find yourself envying younger dancers?
No.
No, why not?
Because I've been there. No, because you know what? I know how hard it is. And also I know how wonderful it is, and I wouldn't take it from them. Envy tends to take things from people. And I don't think that I don't do is something I respect as much as I do dance and dancers.
Do you think there's an artificial line between high art and popular art?
Oh, one of my favorite questions. I think that there is ultimately good art and bad art. I think that there is art that seems as though it is not as demanding, perhaps, called, you know, a more popular form of art than the more elevated form, which is called higher art. But I personally find that anything worth spending time with needs to be both challenging and entertaining. And also the issue of is it of the people or is it of the elite is not very compelling to me because I've always seen energy in both places. And I've seen it because of music. Any great composer, Mozart, Brahms, Bach, Beethoven, uses popular music. They're using popular themes. They're ripping it off right, left, and sideways. And guess what? Then they get ripped off right, left, and sideways. So I don't see that there's an issue here, and I never have. To me, working with the Beethoven Diabelli or the Hammer Klavier, I mean, you know, masterpieces of construction you know, a high, high accomplishment on the part of one individual is no less moving than the music of Scott Joplin.
You have also choreographed pieces, particularly earlier in your career, to silence. Were you, at that time, sort of resentful of the notion that dance was dependent on music?
Not really. I certainly wouldn't have said that, of course. No, really what it was about was learning. Setting out the first 5 years, we performed in silence. There was no music played while we danced. And that was because, as a musician, I know and feel how much more rapidly and easily people communicate orally than they do visually. And that if we were dancing with sad music behind us, people would think it was a sad dance. If we did the same dance with happy music behind us, people would think it was a happy dance. I wanted to know what did people think the dance was, happy or sad, so no music.
And what did you decide for yourself when the time came that you were finished exploring that question?
I haven't gotten there yet. Sometimes, obviously, sometimes, a lot of the time I use music, but I also, most of the time when I'm working with music, will have looked at it without sound.
Do your rehearsals always take place in the spaces where you'll perform things, at least initially?
Never.
Never.
Unfortunately. Would that they could. That's a huge luxury.
How different is it to take something that you've worked on in one space and then stage it somewhere totally
huge.
Different?
Huge. I have myself a very small studio, probably not a lot bigger than this room we're in. Some of the work that gets initiated there has to be expanded into spaces 4-6 times as big. Here it's like one learns to draw in miniature. It's like the cartoons that the fresco painters used to use. They'd do sections of big cartoons, say Michelangelo in the Sistine Chapel. A small cartoon would be done that could be transferred directly to that amount of space, but it had to encompass, it had to be done drafted in many different sections. That's one way of doing it. So the other way of doing it is to do a miniature. And so you're working in a very, very small area, knowing that it's going to be expanded. It's challenging. It's doable. It will change, and one has to be prepared for it to change.
As you're working things out, do you actually write them down and sketch them out on paper, or do you want a human being to sort of demonstrate what it is that you're trying to work through?
Usually I have in the past always done it on my own body. Either I then transfer it to a dancer or put it to videotape. I do also on occasion either make notes with language or image, but for the most part it's with video.
What helps you decide now when you have, I would imagine, the luxury to do whatever sort of projects interest you? How do you decide what you want to do?
Taking situations and opportunities where I feel I can utilize some of the experience that I have, but in a different way, not to repeat.
Mm-hmm. And when you're working with dancers for the first time, are they intimidated by you?
I should think so.
Do you try to temper that, or do you sort of use it to your advantage?
No, because ultimately they're going to be on stage. Ultimately, you want them empowered. Ultimately, you want them to be able to perform with maximum authority. I don't make it easy for them, because if they can't fight through me, they can't fight through an audience. But I certainly want them to get through.
Did you prefer it when a choreographer was very, very hard on you when you were dancing?
I never had a choreographer be very, very hard on me when I was dancing. When I was dancing, I worked only for about 8 months professionally. I danced with the Taylor Company for about 8 months. And he was never hard on me. I was very hard on him.
In what way?
I was very demanding and inappropriately so. I would never have put up with me for nearly as long as he did.
Did you always know that you would ultimately create and choreograph dances as opposed to working? Or did you work as a dancer for a while and think, no, I need to go beyond this?
Yeah, no, I started out loving to dance and I wanted to dance. And then I felt I was restricted by what I was asked to do, and that the challenge was not enough to warrant the investment, and that I could do more.
Is relaxation something that you define differently from other people?
Working on another project simultaneously with one that I'm doing. So if I'm working on a book in the morning, I'm making a dance in the afternoon, that's relaxing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, listen, I'm not a good relaxer, I don't think, which is okay. Not everyone can accomplish that.
Is it hard for people in your personal life to relate to that?
I would say probably.
What kinds of art forms completely outside music and dance are most interesting to you?
Literature and painting. But
mm-hmm. And we were talking in the break, and you said you wonder sometimes why you didn't choose a simpler path like painting. Do you paint?
I have done drawings. I have done elaborate kind of sketches and visualizations. And I thought seriously at one point about becoming a painter. Because I love dancing so much myself is why I didn't. Obviously, I'm not going to become a painter now, although there are things that I have learned from movement that I think can be realized in a visual way that is not painting, but that is a different medium. And that I am interested in.
Bill T. Jones has talked about thinking of dance as a kind of moving sculpture. Do you relate to that?
Not really. No. Sculpture to me is an art form. It's perfectly satisfactory, as is dance.
Mm-hmm. Are there things that shouldn't be attempted in dance, or are there things that it doesn't do well?
Ooh, that hurts me. Yes. I used to have a big, long argument with a dear friend who always argued that you cannot dance and talk at the same time. And I said, oh, Jerry, come on, you certainly can. He said, no, if you want to do the talking, you do the book scenes, and then you do the dancing. I said, no, watch, we can do them together, and we would do them together. He was right in the sense that what I started out discussing with you being that dance is a nonverbal art form, that it suggests better a kind of action that's emotional, and once you put language to it, you reduce it. You do take away some of its grandeur with language. So I would say that ultimately, though, I have tried and tried and will continue to try to make dancing and talking work simultaneously. They probably are at odds with one another.
Is it a different experience directing the same human being in a dance as it is for acting?
You mean is working with actors different from working with dancers?
Yeah, well, I know in some of the things that you've done, dancers and actors perform sort of dual functions, but...
Yes. The dancers, I'm actually working now on a new project, which is a full-length Sinatra, with a group of dancers who are extraordinary, who are also very, very good actors. And in that instance, they are capable of working across that line and superimposing. I mean, we often say that the dancing is the text, and they can function in that way, that a glance can communicate as much as a dance step. Working with actors On occasion, you will find an actor who's very comfortable moving, which is a blessing because they can reference this reservoir of visceral stuff that's in the dancer's body, thinking primarily of themselves as an actor. A really strong dancer, a weak dancer who's a strong actor doesn't really occur that much.
Are American audiences evolving in their understanding of dance as an art form?
I don't know that I would know where to begin to look for an answer to that question because American audiences, first of all, I find that any audience is different from any other audience. That the issue of whether an audience is capable of more or less than they once were in the past, I think they're probably capable of different. I think that the time span, the concentration span that an audience can be expected to deliver is impacted by the technology that's around. And that now speed is an essence, and multitasking is an essence, and that these things will impact on what the audience expects to see in live performance. And that just is a reality. It's not better or worse.
And I guess that's one other thing that you don't fully control when you put a work out there.
No, you don't. And then that's why in the new book, the audience is considered a collaborator.
Twyla Tharp is my guest. We'll resume our conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. Choreographer, writer, and director Twyla Tharp is my guest. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. And that's where we hear from Rollins, who says, would you share a turning point when you felt that you did something perfectly and or the moment that you realized that you had arrived and become sort of a recognized choreographic contender?
Okay, two questions there, perfectly and arrived. Perfectly is not a goal that is in my horizon. Satisfactory is about as far as I get.
Is that because you don't believe in perfect?
No, I love perfect. I think it's a great idea. I think it's an idea. Unfortunately, reality will intercede before you make it to perfect. So I don't expect that, and I'm grateful for pretty good. Pretty good is not enough. No, I'm not grateful for pretty good. I'd be grateful for excellent, but excellent is not perfect. So there's still a reach there. As for the other part of the question about having arrived, that's something that is basically a scary concept to me. I'm not interested in getting to an arrival point because that's Stacy's. I'm interested in continuing to move to other points. So I think often the kind of approval and maybe success that our culture finds to be desirable is for a certain kind of worker not really desirable because in order to be successful in that way, you have to be recognizable. And recognizable means you repeat yourself. So that, again, along with perfection, is not one of my goals.
Do you give a lot of thought to the notion that we are still creating tradition as a society for you as an artist?
this is a key and very intelligent question. Unfortunately, it takes about 10,000 sentences to even get near it. Tradition and work and classicism they're in ongoing evolution is the best way I could put it. I think that we are constantly referencing the past classicism, if you will, in order to inform ourselves about the present, but that's as far as we can get.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hi. My question concerns the whirling dervishes. I want to know if she considers this dance, and if so, what do you understand about it?
Yes, that's a very interesting question. I consider it ritual, and I do consider some dance to be ritual. But in my opinion, ritual is larger than dance, so I don't know that I would call it dance. It's ritual. What do I know about it is not a lot. I've never seen dervishes. I can... I know the mode in which they operate, which is to say that when they turn, they're not what we call in dancing spotting. Spotting requires, as you do a complete revolution, you look to the front and are always relocating your front. That's how Western dance turns. The dervishes do not locate a front, so they are rotating as they revolve with no set axes, and it's a very beautiful thing.
Have you tried it?
I call it spinning. I can do it. I've never pursued it for days on end. I can probably rotate around the room longer than most people you'll run into on the street.
Is there a particular kind of movement that just feels better to you than anything else?
Totally. That's the sort I do.
We have an email from Steve in Dallas who writes, is the creative habit a process that is part of every waking moment, or is it only a component of the time dedicated to practice and performing?
I think of it as pretty much a guiding factor in being alive, whether you're asleep or awake, and some of the nighttime visitations are not pleasant. But that it's not something that I think of turning on and off. It's a point of view that I feel privileged to be able to employ, to look at the world as a source of inspiration all the time.
Going back to the question of perfect versus excellent, do you have to sort of orient your thinking forward so that you don't spend a lot of unnecessary time obsessing over what's already happened and wasn't to your satisfaction?
Obsessing is not going to help you. Feeling guilty about something that was perhaps called a failure or that did not succeed is not going to help you. Just kind of keep going forward. That's not to say you don't try to learn your lessons, but at a certain point you have to let that go and not keep digging away at it. Just let it go. You've learned your lesson. Go on.
What role do you think criticism plays in the art of
None.
Dance? None?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just was being a wee bit sarcastic. I think that criticism is a very valuable tool. I think that it has to be welded with great consideration if the criticism wishes to be useful. I have been in my career very fortunate to have had a number of folks look at the work and to think about it objectively, to try to put it into a context, which is very helpful to me. I did graduate from school with a degree in art history, which means that I was expected to develop a critical eye for work of the past and of the present, to look at it in a context, to see where it sat in relation to other works of art, both from a distant past and from a closer past, and to see how it stood up and where it could be strengthened. I think that's really the point about criticism, is if you approach it from the point of view of where can something be strengthened rather than this is a failure.
Mm-hmm. Referring not to your own works here, but to other things that you consume as a patron of the arts, are you interested in the criticism that is written about things that you might go to see just as a spectator?
No. I don't. I expect to make my own judgment, and I actually expect others to make their own judgment. Nobody speaks for me.
You've talked about the fact that you don't want to go back and do something that you have already done, but I know that your work sometimes are produced by different companies in different contexts. How do you feel about that?
I don't do it. I send out when a ballet is sold for the most part to another company or licensed to another company, people called rehearsal directors, dancers usually, who were in the original cast will go and remount it. That is the same as asking a painter to start their day every day by repainting their last 30 paintings. So that is a practice I have not undertaken. On the other hand, I'm pragmatist enough to hope that some of the work that I've done will be of value when I'm not here. So I watch with an eye over my shoulder to those who are doing this work as a kind of responsibility. I talk with them. We discuss the ongoing nature of the thing, how, again, it might be improved. And it's valuable to me to learn what does resonate. These are new audiences. I mean, some of these pieces that are being taught now were made in the early 70s. So one can't expect them to have the same, they don't sit in the culture in the same kind of way. And this is a real opportunity for me to look at these pieces and say, well, should they be encouraged for the future? Do they have enough to say?
You spoke earlier in the hour about the three distinct phases of your career in sort of 20-year chunks. Was that something that you always planned for and understood, or did it come to the end of the second period when you realized what this really was?
Sometimes I think planning is a very mysterious word. I don't think that consciously I have engineered these passages, shall we say, but that they have materialized.
And when you say that you're not exactly sure what this third phase will you know at the end of it?
Well, I'm not sure about that either. Few workers who work as long as I have actually stopped. Brahms did, but very few actually say, okay, this is it, over. I am looking to my 50th, which is in 2015, and have certain programs in mind that I very much hope to accomplish during that period of time. If it should be that indeed it comes to pass that I do make that milestone, I think at that point I would sit and say, whoa, wait a minute, 50 years, all right. Or I might say, oh, was that 50? Well, okay, fine. It's 51 now and I'm ongoing. I don't know.
Why have you decided to write? Because it seems like it would draw energy off your other work.
It's a different way of analyzing. It's a totally different way of asking questions about the importance of what one's doing, the ways in which you can communicate. What is the thing? It's a way of giving people information that perhaps would not be available to them, which is relevant and which is interesting. Obviously, when the curtain goes up, what you see is what you see. End of story. On the other hand, for those of us who do think somewhat, for lack of a better word, scholarly, that's a long word, about these things, it's interesting to know last year for Seattle, I did two new ballets, one to a Brahms quintet, Opus 111, back-to-back with another work for string, small string orchestra by a Russian minimalist named Vladimir Martynov. They're 100 years apart, almost to the date. And to understand that the Brahms is at the height of the Romantic movement and that the Martynov, in a way, is at the height of the minimalist movement, and to see how Martynov resorts to a return to a more lyric, romantic, if you will, kind of music after this long period of time called modern art is, to me, very, very interesting. Certainly you don't have to have this information to look at the pieces, but looking at them together to really understand why were they done back to back, you do. And this kind of thing needs to be told in language. There are a few people as viewers who would have the sensitivity to music and to the movement that accompanies it to look at it and have that idea, perhaps. Not many. But with the language, I think it opens it to a much more general audience, and I'm very interested in general audiences.
I think the assumption would be for anyone in any field that is as accomplished as you are in yours, that it must come very easily. What do you think about that statement?
Oh, I don't think that's true. I'm sorry. I think it that it comes at all, you're grateful. Again, to use Mozart, who I have researched. I've worked on Amadeus, so I know something about the life of Mozart. He never considered it easy or hard. He just did it every day.
Do you feel like part of what you do, and I understand how much effort goes into staying creative all the time, is it also the way you're wired? Is it just in your genes?
I wouldn't be able to answer that. I am somewhat restless, and I like to keep moving.
Do you think there's a chance that you will, if you stop, that you will realize that you almost can't function without creating in this way?
Oh, dear. No, I mean, because what I don't like to think, and what I think is a very unhealthy thought, is that the work that one does is a codependency, which is the condition that you're describing. It's not that I need to do the work or I will disappear. It's that it's how I understand myself. Certainly, I mean, I'm look, there are lots of things I could do. They're just not as ultimately, I don't quite know that I can find the right word for it. I just don't think of myself in the same terms gardening as I do making dance steps.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you talk about understanding yourself, because it seems like there are two different categories of artists, those who are trying to understand themselves and those who are trying to be understood.
Oh, I think they're hand in glove. I think that when you start, as I talk about in The Creative Habit, in a white space alone by yourself first thing in the day, you're saying, okay, what counts today? And not just to yourself, as a worker in this field, if you're a painter, what? And I'm not saying that a lot of artists go in and look at a canvas, or, you know, Frank Stella or Pollock went in to look at a canvas and say, gee, how should I change the history of art today? Too much. Mm-hmm. I don't think it escaped their thought from time to time.
That's an interesting thing to admit, because a lot of people would never say that out loud.
Well, they'd be wrong.
Is there anything you're particularly excited about that you're working on right now?
Many things, but I don't talk about the future because it changes before it comes to pass. And then I will have done a bad thing. I will have talked an untruth, or I will have lifted expectations, whatever. I can say that I am working on this full-length Sinatra. It will premiere at the Alliance in Atlanta in the middle of September. And it is an interesting project for me because I've used the Sinatra music. This will be the fourth Sinatra. And as a full-length piece separated from the last one by nearly 18 years or something, it has to have changed. How? That's the question.
Twyla, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My privilege. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.